From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. We've got our weekly wrap-up of politics coming out of last night's Democratic presidential debate right here in L.A. Meanwhile, the city just started regulating Airbnbs, but there's already talk that it may change some of those rules. And we've heard a great deal about the Golden State Killer and the women he attacked, but he also targeted men. Now a few are speaking out. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. Coming up...
These people are fun. And not because they're atheists, just mostly because they're musicians.
A look inside an L.A. Christmas choir for the non-religious, that's ahead. Plus, Los Angeles might start relaxing some of those restrictions on Airbnb properties that it just started enforcing. We'll get to why in 20 minutes. But we start today with State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. This week...
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The ayes have it.
The House casts a historic impeachment vote, so why is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi pumping the brakes? Meanwhile...
Making sure that we're able to cover everyone who is, in fact, able to be covered. Hey, put your hand down for a second, Bernie, okay?
Just waving to you, Joe.
I know.
Saying hello.
I know.
Presidential hopefuls went head-to-head last night in L.A. We'll break it down with our two guests. Scott Schaefer is Senior Editor for Politics and Government at KQED. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Josie.
And Marisa Lagos is political correspondent, also at KQED. Together, hi, Marisa.
Hey, Josie.
They host the Political Breakdown podcast, and I'm so glad to have both of you here. Scott, I want to start with you. Some very long simmering rivalries really came to the fore in last night's debate. You were there. What did you see from your vantage point?
Well, I mean, clearly, this was Pete Buttigieg's night to be in the barrel, wine barrel, you might say. We can get to that in a second. But, you know, he's been pretty unscathed through these debates, even as he's been rising in the polls and doing so well in fundraising. And that all changed last night. The big exchange, I think, that was most memorable was between him and Elizabeth Warren. She was noting that he had held recently a fundraiser in this wine cave with crystals in Napa Valley, where they were serving apparently $900 bottles of wine.
And showing you said crystals that he is, with crystals?
Crystals. Yeah, I wasn't sure what she meant until I saw the photograph. It was like crystal chandeliers. Yeah.
These wine
caves.
Okay.
And apparently... Apparently, Gavin Newsom said afterwards that, like, a lot, and by that I mean like 100 or more Democrats have had fundraisers at that winery in Napa.
Okay.
So he's in good company. But, you know, I think he did a good job of turning that around on her, saying that, you know, he's proud to take money from anyone who wants to help him defeat Trump, pointing out that he was the only person on the stage who wasn't a millionaire or a billionaire, and then also pointing out some hypocrisy on her part that she had taken money like that from big donors for her Senate race, which she then transferred into her presidential campaign. And then, of course, the other big dynamic, I think, last night was between Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. She really questioning him over his experience and kind of dismissing the experience that senators have, which he did in the last debate. So I think that those both of those candidates going after him and his ability to, you know, take a punch and swing back and not get flustered and really hold his own, I think that was really the big dynamic of the night.
Definitely. And Buttigieg, he made a big point of saying that the other candidates had to be sure that they could pass purity tests. But Marisa, I also have heard the point made that Buttigieg is only 37 and he is not a millionaire, but may very likely become one in the future. What stood out to you about the back and forth between him and Warren and Klobuchar?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was interesting. I was actually thinking that as you said it, that if I were Elizabeth Warren, I might point that out, that, you know, she probably wasn't a millionaire at 38 or 37 either. I thought it was interesting in the sense that it felt like Amy Klobuchar really sort of personally dislikes Pete Buttigieg. And I think, you know, we've seen this dynamic with a couple other candidates where obviously they all have sort of punches they want to land on the people they see as political, like politically threatening to them. But then there's, you know, something beyond that where it does seem like maybe they just, there's something about them that gets under their skin. You know,
and what do you think that is, Marisa? What do you think it is about Buttigieg that just makes some people's skin crawl?
Well, I think for Klobuchar, I think she feels like she's tried to stake out this place in this race, right, where she is this Midwesterner who has experience sort of carrying more purple states. And I think she really sees him as inexperienced and not really ready for the big stage yet. Now, I think we can have a debate over whether that's fair. And, you know, everybody takes different paths. But I think my sense is that she feels sort of encroached upon in terms of they're both Midwesterners and sort of staking out a more moderate path. Mm-hmm. I thought Warren handled the Buttigieg sort of back and forth very well. I thought one thing that struck me beyond those three candidates that really interesting is how Bernie Sanders handled questions about race. He was asked some pretty pointed questions about both his age, but also about being a white man and about sort of how to bring along a coalition. And he seemed really uncomfortable with those questions. Mm. But then when we got to an issue like immigration, he was really in his element, I found it really fascinating that when it was personal, it was hard for him to talk about. And when it flipped to policy, he mm-hmm. almost is better at making a sort of emotional plea about something. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the moderators called him out on that once when he tried to sort of avoid a question switching over to climate change.
That's right.
But I thought that was an interesting.
I would just add, too, that I think there is some real personal dislike from Klobuchar toward Buttigieg. And I think it's because she feels, and she has said this, that if another woman had his resume, they wouldn't mm-hmm. be taken as seriously as he's been. And I think there's a gender element also to that dislike, as mm-hmm. well as, you know, he can be a little smarmy sometimes, a little kind of smartest kid in the class. And I think that, you know, that does get under the skin of some of the other candidates.
Right. And Klobuchar has been said to have been the target of gender bias in that she has been accused of being very hard on her staff, and her defenders say that, you know, if she were a man, she wouldn't be getting the same kind of complaints. So Marisa, earlier you were saying that immigration did come up. Scott, candidates did talk about immigration, which matters to Californians. They did talk about foreign policy and healthcare. But what about two major issues for us in California, housing and homelessness? I didn't hear much about that. And you would think it would make sense that when candidates come to a state where they're going to be debating, that they'd address issues that the people who live here are interested in. Do you know why they didn't talk about that?
Well, I was really disappointed that they didn't get into California issues very much. They mentioned Paradise, California, and the wildfire victims there, and there was some question about that. But, you know, I think in terms of the housing question specifically, I think if Julian Castro, the former HUD secretary, had been on the stage, and in fact, he was in Los Angeles touring Skid Row and doing other things while the debate was happening. But I think if he had been up there, he would have mentioned that, because that's really part of his wheelhouse. I think, you know, here we are in California, and there are so many big issues that are unique to this state. I mean, Silicon Valley, all the issues around the gig economy and privacy and misinformation that's being spread around. I was really, really disappointed that none of those things came up. And I think if there had been at least one of the debate panelists from California, that might have helped. But I think that all of them were from the East Coast, and I do think they bring that bias with them. And, you know, I understand it is a national event. It's a national audience. But there are ways to make a nod to where you are, whether it's on mass shootings and the Gilroy Garlic Festival, things like that. I mean, you can put yourself in a place without completely hijacking mm-hmm. the conversation to make it about California. So I was disappointed. I mean, Barbara Lee did get a couple of nice shout-outs, and so did the governor. The governor was recognized by
Barbara Lee for not voting for the war in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan mm-hmm. war, right, and also for pushing change in the way military power is wielded and the congressional role in that. So that was kind of a surprise. I'm sure she didn't expect to get two shout-outs. But yeah, I was disappointed. And, you know, it was a debate that could have been held anywhere, really.
Right. Marisa, so it was a surprise we didn't hear much about housing, but we knew an impeachment question was coming, and all the candidates seemed to agree on the topic, though businessman Andrew Yang did make one criticism. Let's hear what he said.
What we have to do is we have to stop being obsessed over impeachment, which unfortunately strikes many Americans like a ball game where you know what the score is going to be.
He went on to say that candidates should really put the focus on the problems that got Trump elected in the first place. So, Marisa, do you think there's some merit to this point?
I mean, absolutely there's merit, and we saw it because that's what Democrats did last year to win back the House of Representatives. They weren't, you know, just talking about Trump. Some of them did, and some of them ignored it pretty much entirely. What they focused on was health care. And I think that that's something that, you know, whoever becomes the nominee is really going to have to grapple with, sort of being able to walk and chew gum. I mean, of course, mm-hmm. you're going to attack your opponent, especially someone like Trump, who clearly isn't going to stop attacking the Democrats. But I think that they also have to make the case, especially to voters who do seem on all sides really just sick of the sort of nastiness of Washington, you know, that they need to make the case that what they want to do is going to make their lives better, not just, you know, move Trump and sort of leave us with the same problems. I think that that really gets to a key difference between some of the more progressive candidates like Warren and Sanders and the sort of message that Biden and Buttigieg are putting out there. You know, we've seen ads from someone like Biden where he's only focusing on President Trump. But, you know, it is a difficult thing, I think, at this point, considering even with some of those differences, this is a stage full of Democrats, right? And so, like, they are going to all agree on opposing the president. And on a lot of the issues, you know, there's a lot of daylight around health care, but there may not be around some of the other issues that they might be talking more about in the general election.
If you're just joining us now, this is State of Affairs on Take Two. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez, and I'm talking to Scott Schaefer and Marisa Lagos. They host the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. Scott, you were mentioning a little bit earlier that Julian Castro was not on the debate floor. Just seven candidates met polling and fundraising requirements to qualify for last night's debate. 15 Democrats, though, are still in the race. When are we going to see the field winnow down? And what is it going to take?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've already seen it winnow down a bit. I think most people would be hard-pressed to name those other eight Democrats, with the exception maybe of Cory Booker and Mike Bloomberg. But, you know, the criteria for the next debate is going to be a little tougher. It's going to be 7 points or higher in a couple of polls in the first four states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. So that'll winnow it down a little bit. And then I think just the election in Iowa, the caucus on the 3rd of February, and New Hampshire's primary on the 11th, that's really going to be key, I think, especially for Amy Klobuchar, who doesn't have a lot of money. And if she doesn't do well, she doesn't have to win necessarily, but I think in Iowa, she's got to come in the top three. And if she doesn't, you know, that may be the end of her campaign as well. Somebody like Andrew Yang seems to be just really have a core
Energizer
of support.
Bunny. Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's an Energizer Bunny. He's funny, but I do think he's going to – I've never seen a poll where he's higher than like 4 or 5%. So he may have trouble, you know, being on the debate stage as well. Same for Tom Steyer. So, you know, it's going to happen. I mean, no one's voted yet. So, I think it would be nice to have the voters weigh in before we start winnowing the field a lot further. And I think that's what will happen after the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries there, caucus and primary.
All right. Marisa, we just have a few minutes left, so I want to move over to D.C. and point out that a divided House of Representatives voted to impeach President Trump on Wednesday, I believe. But now Speaker Pelosi is holding back from sending those charges to the Senate. So can you explain why she's doing this? Why go through all of this?
Yeah, this has been turned into a really interesting sort of battle royale in Washington. I mean, essentially, she and other Democrats feel like they have no indication that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, intends to give this what they see as a fair trial, that they think that he's going to try to rush this through to exonerate the president, and they want to see some sort of framework set out for exactly what it's going to look like and ensure that it's going to be a trial, not just sort of a vote. But it does put her in a sticky place, because Democrats really pushed this through quickly and felt like it needed to happen. And now they're kind of in this position where, you know, you have arguably two of the best negotiators or leaders in Washington facing off here. And I don't know what a win looks like for either side.
Mm-hmm. Scott, what's your take?
Well, you know, I wouldn't second guess Nancy Pelosi's strategy on this. I don't know exactly what she has in mind. I think she is trying to get some leverage here and what kind of a process there will be in the Senate. But, you know, as we've seen all along, she is a master negotiator and strategist. And I think that when she sees maybe it's time to fold the cards and just send it over to the Senate, she will do that. Because I do think there is a potential for backlash if she holds it back too long. She did extend, I see today, an invitation to him, the president, to speak in Congress for the State of the Union address on February 4th. So, I know my guess is she'll be sending that over to the Senate before too long.
Mm. Marisa, we just have a minute left, and I wanted to ask you about a conservative op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, which said that McConnell should give Pelosi a public deadline to appoint House managers. And we've talked a lot on the show about Pelosi as an effective political operator, but as you guys were mentioning, McConnell is he's not a shabby at this either. So could she potentially get outmaneuvered if she just holds back too long?
I mean, look, Republicans control the Senate, so she really only has so much leverage. But I think that, to Scott's point, she's going to continue reading the tea leaves and react as necessary. It's entirely possible they get something out of McConnell. Whether it's everything Democrats want is unlikely. Whether it's a conviction is even more unlikely. But I do think that there's a possibility that Pelosi can work something with the majority leader, so it's a little bit more what Democrats would like to see in terms of the process.
All right. Marisa Lagos is political correspondent at KQED, and Scott Schaefer is their senior editor for politics and government. You two have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
You too.
Coming up, we have a conversation with someone who perhaps been following the cases of the Golden State Killer like no other person. You may have followed Paige St. John on her podcast, Man in the Window. Well, she's going to tell us about an angle that she came to late in the game after she did her podcast. Stay tuned to hear more. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Los Angeles has only just started enforcing its regulations on Airbnb and other home sharing sites just a handful of weeks ago. And those actions came pretty late in the game, actually. And many other cities have been in doing this and cracking down on the different home sharing sites years ago, actually. So there's now talk that the city might relax some of those very rules. Jenna Chandler has been following the latest for the website Curbed LA, where she's an editor, and she's with us now. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jenna, before we get to what the potential changes are, can you remind us why LA wanted to regulate short-term rentals in the first place?
So Los Angeles is in the midst of this housing crisis. There's not enough housing, and there's this concern that Airbnb hosts are taking units that could otherwise be used for long-time residents and renters off the rental market. It's more lucrative for hosts to rent them on a short-term basis than it is to rent them on the long-term.
So what is the rule that the city came up with?
Yeah, the rules now are that one, hosts have to actually register with the city planning department, and they have to pay an $89 fee. They cannot rent out units or homes that are rent controlled, and they can't rent a home for more than 120 days in a calendar year. And the home has to be their primary residence, which means they have to live in the home for at least 6 months per year.
So these rules just took effect, but now you have some officials who want to let people rent out second homes, or what people more commonly called vacation homes. And earlier this week, the LA Planning Commission recommended that Angelenos be allowed to rent out a home in addition to their primary residence. So why do planning officials want to loosen the rules that are just getting going now?
Well, so hosts have been saying, you know, kind of like they were saying with traditional short-term rentals, is like they depend on these for income, like they need them to help pay their mortgage or maybe to save for retirement, and that they should be able to rent out these units. And so the city is trying to strike a compromise between that and people who want to have them regulated.
But the Planning Commission and its recommendations have already gotten backlash. Can you tell us about that?
It's mainly that there are some people who believe that these shouldn't be on the short-term rental market, that the city should be prioritizing long-term tenants and long-time renters over short-timers, over visitors, over tourists.
Outside of trying to regulate second homes, the city's already having a lot of issues regulating home sharing in a place as humongous as LA. And how have you seen this showing up as a problem?
The city started enforcing November 1st. What it did was it hired a contractor to comb through listings and see who was in compliance and who's not in compliance. And one of the main things they're looking for is who has a registration number on their listing. And if they don't have a registration number, they're sending letters to hosts telling them, hey, you're not in compliance. And they're giving them a time frame to come into compliance. So they started issuing those letters. And now what they're going to do is starting in January, they're actually going to start issuing citations and fines to hosts who have not come into compliance. And some of these groups who are urging the city council to keep their ban on vacation rentals, they're saying, look, you're not doing a good enough job enforcing the rules that you have on the books right now. Why don't you focus on doing that?
So what is on the table for LA to try and regulate things more effectively?
They're kind of sticking to their plan on how to enforce this, right? Which was they rolled out the new rules last year and then they said, we're going to give hosts time to like learn about these rules and for these platforms to share the rules with the hosts. And then we're going to start enforcing on November 1st. And now that they've started issuing these like letters to people who are in violation, now the next phase is that they're going to start actually issuing citations and fines.
So as we've been saying, LA is just a few weeks into enforcing these new home sharing rules. Can you, Jenna, already see some more problems that lie ahead and how they might have to be addressed?
I think if they can actually, you know, keep a good tabs on hosts who have registration numbers and who don't, I think that will be like the biggest issue. And I think it might be good too for them to consider how to educate hosts and then also how to educate people who are looking to book in LA. I've talked to a number of people who have tried, you know, who are visiting or plan to visit LA and aren't aware of the rules and they're booking, trying to book Airbnbs. And then, you know, then the hosts are telling them, oh, I got a citation letter from the city. My apartment is rent controlled. I can't actually go through with this booking.
All right. Jenna Chandler, editor of Curbed LA. Thanks so much for joining us and talking about short-term rentals.
Thank you.
Now, a warning. This next story, it does contain several references to sexual assault. For more than 10 years, the killer committed at least 50 rapes, 13 murders, and over 100 burglaries all over California. The serial rapist's first victims were solely women and girls. Within a year, the attacks focused on couples. But while the trauma of the female victims continues to be retold today, little has been said about the male victims. Paige St. John covers criminal justice and investigative stories for the LA Times. She's also host of the podcast about the Golden State Killer called Man in the Window. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
The Golden State Killer is regarded as one of California's deadliest serial killers, but this angle about the male victims is not often talked about in the extensive coverage about him. What made you want to look into it?
I was midway through doing the podcast when I was awakened one morning about 6:30 in the morning by a phone call and a very angry sounding man on the other side. He wasn't angry at me. He was just terribly angry over the issue. He turned out to be one of those male victims and was willing to come forward and tell his story.
Yes, the men also seem to be clearly the target of the Golden State Killer, but it was more of a psychological warfare. Could you tell us about some of the things the men would experience during the attacks?
In almost every single of the attacks on the couples, the men would be bound in the bedroom. Their wives or girlfriends would be led out of the room and raped in an adjacent room. And during that process, the rapist would come back into the bedroom with the men and hold a gun to the back of the heads of the men and taunt them about their powerlessness, their inability to do anything to protect the women, you know, in the next room. And in some cases, including Victor, the case of one of the men I interviewed, he would use names of other family members. He told Victor, Sharon is next. And Sharon is the name of Victor's mother.
So Victor was one of two male victims you spoke with in your story about their experiences. And these are the only two people who have publicly come forward. Was Victor the person who contacted you after your podcast came out?
He was. He was victim 23, I believe. And that's how he identified himself. He clarified who he was on the phone using a shorthand of all of the victims of the Golden State Killer. They tend to introduce each other to each other by their number of crime. But after Victor began speaking with me, another female victim convinced her husband to talk about his experience. So Bob Hardwick as well talked about what it was like to be traumatized in an age when men are not allowed to acknowledge their trauma.
Yes, and let's first talk about Victor Hayes, because as you describe him in your story, he was very much a man of his time in the 70s, long hair, muscle car, the picture of masculinity. And as you mentioned, he and his girlfriend were targeted in the 1970s. Can he tell you what happened to him and how he coped with the fallout from the attack?
There were little things that Victor knows was done to basically taunt his masculinity, a man-to-man message that you're powerless or I dominate you, including leaving a half-eaten pie on the seat of Victor's motorcycle. And to this day, Victor still wrestles with the agony of not having that chance to go one-on-one with the attacker, this masculine expectation that you should protect the women around you.
You're really able to encapsulate the rage and frustration he felt after the attack, and also the sense of neglect that he received from law enforcement, because after the attack by the Golden State Killer, how was he treated by police?
The mood in the room changed the moment his girlfriend was taken away to the hospital. So Victor's left at the crime scene. It's his townhome. And there are crime scene technicians there and detectives there. And they begin chatting and joking among themselves as though there's no victim in the room. And it was incredible in terms of the emotional harm to Victor. Like, he didn't count. He didn't matter. And from that moment on, he just kind of shut down and he stopped talking about the rape. He never told them a lot of the details of the crime itself because he felt that there was no respect for him.
If you're just joining us now, we're speaking with LA Times investigative reporter Paige St. John, who has extensively covered the Golden State Killer cases. Paige, the second victim you spoke with was Bob Hardwick, who actually went on to marry his partner after this attack, which is a really interesting revelation because this is something that you think would tear couples asunder. What was Bob's experience and that of his now wife?
Yeah, more than half of the couples did not stay together after the attack, and it very nearly destroyed the relationship between Bob and Gay. The trauma of the attack for her was so that she went to counseling, she changed careers, she tried to deal with the stress and all the things that the women typically did, but Bob did not, and kind of felt that he didn't have to acknowledge, he didn't even think of himself as a victim. Gay was the victim, he was not, right? So anger began to creep out in his life. This is a very soft-spoken man. He speaks so softly, you have to lean forward to hear him. And I think they reached a point that they realized it had gotten too much. They were on the verge of separation and divorce. Bob and Gay sat down, went out to dinner, and kind of reached a deliberate conclusion that and decision that they had to deal with this and they weren't going to let it get the better of them.
So how did Bob address this anger and how did he begin to process the trauma in a healthier way without going to therapy?
Right, because as he made clear, he said, for the record, I will never go into therapy. He poured himself into sports. He plays some 300 softball games a year. He's in two leagues. He golfs and is on a golfing league as well, and he does downhill skiing. So he is constantly in motion. And I had an expert in male trauma who suggests that talk therapy is not very effective for men sometimes, and sports therapy is a very real alternative for men to deal with trauma.
Paige, you cover criminal justice. Do you feel that if something as terrible as what happened to Victor and Bob were to happen today, would they have been treated the same way by law enforcement?
I think a lot has changed. Law enforcement and rape crisis counseling centers are beginning to recognize male trauma. Not completely so, though, because I continue to get emails from male readers who read the series who say if it was them, they never would have let this happen. You know, there's still a masculine belief that in some way they could have outmaneuvered or dealt with the serial rapist. Though I have to say that the moment men did begin to fight back is when he began to kill them. But it's the experts that I spoke to say this is still a very new arena that male trauma and male victims don't yet have full recognition.
Well, we look forward to hearing more from you about this. Paige St. John covers criminal justice and investigative stories for the LA Times. She's also host of the podcast Man in the Window, which uncovered never-before-revealed details about the Golden State Killer. Paige, thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for giving your attention to this important issue.
Next on Take Two, we're going to take you for some holiday fun in Little Tokyo so you can meet someone called Shogun Santa. And then we're going to go to Echo Park to a place called the Heretic Park. Stay tuned. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. Christmas, less than a week away, and the Santas have been out in droves. You've seen them in malls, company parties, preschools. Me, I was never a fan as a kid of sitting on a strange man's lap, but I have to wonder, what if Santa had been Asian like me? What if he looked more like my uncle? Would I have been more comfortable? Maybe. Well, LA's most famous Asian Santa tradition is back. Shogun Santa has returned to Little Tokyo after a big loss in the community last year. And to find out more, I went to Little Tokyo this week. Over at the Japanese Village Shopping Plaza, Sacramento State student Mark Omatz stops and stares.
I'm so excited about this, genuinely.
Before him is a Santa in a shiny gold Shogun helmet, crimson robe, and thonged sandals. He and his friends pose for a free photo.
You don't see an Asian Santa. Like, I feel like you just never see an Asian anything in general, as diverse as California is.
LA may be a majority-minority city, but few places advertise Santas of color. Little Tokyo went without one for decades. The original Shogun Santa debuted in the 1980s, but only lasted a few years. Then in 2014, business leaders revived the character to attract holiday shoppers. Actor-activist Rodney Kageyama, a local celeb, was their pick. Friend Ellen Endo says he threw himself into the role.
He would say, Ellen, is my helmet on straight? My beard is slipping, I think. Can you adjust it for me? So I was kind of his personal assistant for a while.
But Kageyama had multiple health problems, and last December, before he was set to put on the Santa suit for the fifth season, he died in his sleep at age 77. Mike Okamoto, the president of the Little Tokyo Business Association, has since stepped into the role. In between photos, Okamoto looks down and wriggles his feet. It's tradition to wear white socks with these sandals, but Kageyama told him to wear red.
It's a way of saying, okay, this is not really Japanese, you know, but some twist to it.
Omas, the college student, is Filipino-American, and he loves this version of Santa.
There's not just one way that things are right. And being able to show people at a young age, you know, this is also for you.
Well, he says that's great for kids, even big kids like him. If you want to meet Shogun Santa, he'll be at Japanese Village in Little Tokyo this Saturday and Sunday from 11 to 3. Now, the holidays are a time when you're encountering religious music everywhere. Carolers are caroling, Silent Night follows you through the aisles of the grocery store, and religious choirs are dusting off their sleigh bells. But there's one choir in L.A. that's singing a different kind of tune. Contributor Natalie Chinofsky takes you there.
The first thing I notice when I enter the Heretic House is that it's covered in Christmas decorations, although I am quickly corrected.
They are solstice decorations. They are not Christmas decorations.
You're still embracing the festivity of holidays.
I didn't become an atheist to miss any parties.
My name is Bobby Kirkhart, and I'm a longtime atheist activist, especially with Atheists United.
She was actually the president of Atheists United, and we're inside her Craftsman House in Echo Park.
I call it Heretic House. That's a nickname, I guess. And I bought it with the idea that we would have a lot of free thought activities here, and we do. We've had game night, the Atheist United board meets here, but probably my favorite is the choir because I get to listen.
Voices of Reason. My name is Katie Sharp, and I am the director of the a cappella choir Voices of Reason. Voices of Reason is a secular a cappella choir founded here in Los Angeles around 2011, and we sing songs that are appropriate for a secular crowd.
Evolution, 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 evolution.
The choir is sponsored by Atheists United, and they meet here at the Heretic House twice a month. Today, they're practicing for their next performance, a winter solstice event for the Humanist Society of Santa Barbara. They perform all kinds of music about secularism, science, though they try to avoid anything overtly political or anti-religious. You'll hear them singing Monty Python, Avenue Q, Roy Zimmerman. You can probably spot the trend.
So mostly we perform comedy. We find that for the kinds of crowds that we like to perform to, they all need to kind of lighten up a little bit and not take themselves so seriously.
Those crowds include science conferences and libraries, but mostly they're atheist groups.
They're very political. They have a lot of very strong opinions. And so we come in and we're like, okay, guys, how about we just have a laugh?
Occasionally they write their own lyrics, like Evolution, which was mostly written by Amanda McLean, the co-founder of Voices of Reason and a lifelong atheist.
Choral music is rooted in the church. So most choral works that are not modern choral works are going to be religious works. I joined this community college choir in Orange County and was really bowled over by how much Jesus content I had to sing. So I went online and I was looking for Atheist Choir Los Angeles, and I was thinking I was going to find 20 atheist choirs from which to choose. And all I found was a dead link to the previous Voices of Reason.
That iteration of the choir had disbanded in 2004. In 2011, Amanda helped restart Voices of Reason. And according to Bobby Kirkhart, it's the only atheist choir in the United States, one of three in the world. Today, they have 12 to 15 core members.
Well, you know, you don't have to be an atheist to join us either. We accept everybody. Just as long as you want to sing our content, we'll take you.
Some members identify as agnostic or spiritual. And then there's David, who described himself by quoting Monty Python.
I am a Roman Catholic and have been since before I was born. And that's true about me. I'm David J. McGee, and I sing bass and sometimes solo.
David originally joined the choir with his wife, who was exploring atheism at the time. She's since left, but he keeps coming back. So I asked him why.
Oh, God, it's fun. These people are fun. And not because they're atheists, just mostly because they're musicians. And I've made good friends.
That's a sentiment echoed by a lot of the choir members I talked to. For example, the director, Katie Sharp, who came to L.A. from New Zealand.
L.A. is so spread out, and there's so many people here, but somehow it's extremely isolating. Now I've thrown myself into this community, and I think it's really helped me, and I think it's really helped other people who live in L.A. and who have also come to L.A. looking for a community that is not religious.
Dysfunctional family.
I think it's fair to say that Katie has found a family with Voices of Reason. Her now partner is Yari Schutzer, the other co-founder of Voices of Reason. Both Amanda and Katie independently told me that they're best friends, which is really cute. And for Bobby Kirkhart, the owner of the Heretic House, that's one of the great values of music.
We must communicate by emotion. We cannot leave that out of our community.
For Take Two, I'm Natalie Chinofsky.
Coming up, we're going to talk latkes with our resident expert on all things delicious, Elena Shatkin. She's food editor at our website, las.com, and she's got the history and the recipes for those yummy potato pancakes. Stay tuned.
Ourselves, then we're free.
The Frame is coming up this afternoon, and we have host John Horn in studio with us. What can we look forward to?
Well, it depends if you want the daily show or the weekend show, and maybe you'll hear a little bit of both.
Sure.
But let me talk about the weekend show. Saturday at 2, we've got some good movie stuff. We have an interview with Greta Gerwig, the writer-director of Little Women. Highly recommend that. If you want to see a movie that's a little more difficult, 1917, the World War I film, we talked to Sam Mendes and Roger Deakins. The movie is shot in one take, or at least it's supposed to look like one take. Then we have a couple of interesting little stories. There's a photographer named Thomas Kiefer. He was a janitor at a border detention facility. He collected items been confiscated by people trying to cross the border. He put together a show that's at the Skirball. That's amazing. And then we talk with a writer named Whitney Friedlander, who talks about stereotypes and archetypes of Jewish women on television, talking about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Transparent, and then finally, The Blacklist, the best unproduced screenplays in Hollywood.
Oh, great. That's On the Frame, coming up at 3:30 today and also on the weekend.
You got it. Saturday at 2.
Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Hanukkah begins this Sunday, December 22nd at sundown. The Festival of Lights runs for 8 days and is honored by traditions such as playing with dreidels, lighting menorahs, and eating tasty morsels. Like latkes, those crispy and oh-so-delicious potato pancakes. Elena Shatkin is the food editor for LAist and an expert on all things Hanukkah and latkes. So we invited her on to talk about it all, and she kicked off her conversation with A. Martinez by talking about the holiday's history.
Picture it. Jerusalem, 165 BC. The Jews of Judea and Samaria are not having a great time with their king, Antiochus IV. Did I say that right? Anyway,
That's good being. Yeah, sounds good.
All right. He's oppressing them. He's outlawing some of their customs. He's desecrated the Second Temple, and they are mad. So a group of Jews known as the Maccabees, they're five brothers. They're probably pretty buff, probably have pretty good abs. I'm assuming they're CrossFitters. I don't know. Anyway, they lead a rebellion. And this tiny band of really buff brothers basically overthrows the king, and they decide to honor that by holding a festival. And they only have a little bit of oil, just enough to burn for one night. But somehow, through the power of spirituality and magic and victory, it burns for 8 nights. Hence, you have the 8-night festival of Hanukkah.
All right, so burning oil, central point of the story, clearly. Is there a connection between that and the food that we've come to enjoy during that time?
Why, yes, there is. So here's the deal. To honor this concept that just a little bit of oil went a long ways and burned for 8 days, we do that by frying food in oil and eating it. It's really as simple as that.
Now, let's talk about the star of the show, because that is the latke. Now, what ingredients does it consist of? I mean, I know potatoes for sure. What else?
The latke is a very simple dish. It is a potato pancake. It's essentially like a smashed down fried hash brown patty. You could think of it as such. It is potatoes, a little bit of egg, a little bit of flour, a little bit of salt and pepper, and some chopped up onions.
That's it? Really?
That's it. What is that? 5-6 things?
That's nothing.
Yeah.
That's easy.
It's very simple, really. But the thing is the prep.
So what about the prep?
Well, it's a pretty time-consuming prep if you want to do it right. I have a special way that I do it. And then also, when you fry it, just know that your home will smell like fried oil for days on end.
That's
afterwards.
Fine with me.
Okay. So I do a special prep. I think this is hands down the best way to do it. One of the problems with latkes is you either grate or shred the potatoes, right? And there's, you know, and then you mix them with the eggs, the flour, the salt, the pepper, the onions. And they're sitting there. And as soon as the potatoes hit the air, they start to oxidize and they start to turn kind of gray. And that's just never really an appealing color for food. So here is the best trick that I know. When I make my latkes, I start my latke prep a day in advance, literally 24 hours beforehand.
Okay.
What I do, throw the potatoes into a pot, and I just used, you know, big, cheap, brown, russet potatoes, nothing fancy. Throw them in a pot, throw some water in, bring them to a quick boil. As soon as they start boiling, take them off the water, you drain them, and let them cool. Put them in the fridge for a day. It's a little bit similar to the techniques that a lot of places use when they make, you know, French fries or potato dishes, where they soak potatoes overnight in water to basically remove the starch, things like that. So the next day, when you're ready to do your actual latkes, you peel the potatoes, you shred or you grate them, you know, you mix up your ingredients, you know, you start making them into little balls or patties and pressing them down in the pan, and you've got this whole bowl of latke mush, and it's not getting gray.
Wow. So, I mean, it's a 24-hour thing for you then. I mean, it's not just, you could just do whip them up in a second if you're starting from scratch.
I mean, there's a lot of rest time in between. I don't, you know, stand there staring at the potatoes for 24 hours.
But still, things are happening, though.
Yeah. So, and the thing about latkes is this. They are really best eaten fresh. Yeah. They really, really are. In between the frozen latkes you can get in Trader Joe's and the ones you make fresh, for me, there is no middle ground. Like, I don't like anything in between. And the fresh ones are just so good and so vastly better than the frozen kind or anything like that. It's not even a comparison. So the ingredients are easy, but there are many steps to do it. And in my list, when I wrote the recipe for LAist, I actually counted, and I think there were 27?
27.
27 steps, which explains why, even though the ingredients are very simple, I only do this once a year.
Yeah. So if you're going to do it right, you should follow the steps and take your time then. Don't just slap them together.
Yeah. You want to put a little love and care. And, you know, as soon as they come out of the oil in the pan or the deep fryer, pat them dry with a little paper towel. I like to hit them with a little bit of sea salt, serve them up on a plate with some sour cream and, you know, applesauce if people prefer.
Mm-hmm. No. Sour cream sounds all right.
I also do a little thing where I take some sour cream aside. I mix it in with a little sriracha, so you also have spicy sour cream as an option.
Ooh, wow. So, okay, so if you were experiencing someone else's latkes, what would be the thing that you would look for to make it a good latke?
I like it to be nice and crisp on the outside, real Christmas, but kind of soft and just a little bit mushy on the inside.
It's texture. Isn't it all about texture? I mean, it doesn't matter what food, it's all about texture.
Yeah, and a good hit of onion and just enough salt.
That's LA's food editor, Elena Shatkin, talking about Hanukkah and all things latke. Elena, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And if you're just so hungry now and you need to get your hands on Elena's latke recipe and you know how to cook, you can find it at LAist.com. But if making them seems a little hard, me raising hand here, you can stop off at Langer's Deli on Alvarado or Canner's on Fairfax to pick some up. If you have a favorite place for latkes, tweet us at Take Two. Finally, we put a bow on today's show with some ideas of what to do right before the holidays.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. Josie, perhaps you aren't headed out of town for the weekend and your sleigh ride is going to be a short one. So for those sticking around for the holidays, there's still a lot to do.
Tell us, please.
Okay, so first, you can get away from the news. Yeah, I know following politics is kind of important. It's been quite the year, right? But get a palate cleanser tonight at the Dynasty Typewriter Theater in Westlake. So these comedians are going to be taking stage for the show called Everything's Great, which it is. It's hosted by...
up for debate.
It's hosted by Demi Adejuibe, Adi Weirich, and Nick Kocher. And they're bringing on their friends like Rachel Bloom, as well as Margaret Cho. And they promise you'll leave feeling more hopeful about the world, or at least laughing enough about it to forget about those problems for like 2-3 hours. And when you go, tickets start at 10.
But Leo, what if I just don't want to get away just from politics, but I want to get away from LA? Period.
That's like me every weekend. I think nature is gonna be what you need. You can go to sleep early tonight so you can get up early tomorrow morning for a climb of Mount Baldy. So the organization Empowered by Adventure is hosting a slow climb, a snow climb up this mountain in the San Gabriel Mountains, and it's designed for beginners. So don't worry if you've never done it before. They'll actually be there to show you and provide some of the gear you need. Just obviously bring a lot of warm clothes and wear long johns or thermals or whatever you call them. It does get super cold up there, and when you go, it's free.
What if you don't like the cold? I know I'm saying a lot of what ifs, but if you don't like the cold, how can you heat up?
With some salsa.
Hola, Marco. Puerto Rico.
Okay, so we're listening to the sounds of the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. Tomorrow, they're going to be taking the stage at the Segerstrom Center in Costa Mesa for Salsa Navidad. So enjoy a whole night of music to shake your sleigh bells to. And tickets for that one start at $39. Now, that is not all. The KPCC LAS gang have a lot more to share of what to do this weekend. You can check it out on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com. And if you want to, you can find me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat.
He's a good follow. That's our own Leo Duran. Thanks, Leo.
See you later, Josie.
Finally, today, for cannabis consumers out there, there's a new program from state regulators that'll help customers check the legality of their purchases using a QR code reader. QR codes are, you know, those checkered boxes you can scan with your smartphone camera. The announcement came down yesterday from the Bureau of Cannabis Control. That's the State Department charged with rolling out rules on sale and distribution of pot. Spokesman for the Bureau, Alex Traverso, explains how the tech works.
The consumer would come up to the door of a licensed retail location, and then using their smartphone, they can hold the phone up and it'll scan the code. And then on their phone, they'll be able to see all the information about that business's license.
Now, illegal dealers and retailers have negatively affected projected profits after pot legalization in 2016 by Prop 64. Traverso says the move that they're doing over at the Bureau will also help consumers make an informed decision about their health.
It's not just about, oh, this is going to cost me 10 bucks less, so I'm going to shop at this illegal shop. It's getting a vape cartridge that has, you know, vitamin E acetate in it that could, you know, make you extremely sick or potentially even kill you.
For people who do not have QR readers, do not fret. You can still check a shop on the Bureau's website, capotcheck.com. That's it for Take Two this week. Our show is produced and directed by Leo Duran, Lori Skywalker-Galaretta, and Austin Cross. Caroline Champlin helped us out this week. Our senior producer is Megan Larson. Our engineer is Hasmik Pogosian. And our news apprentice is Tamika Adams. And I am so sad to say that today is Tamika's last day with us. Tamika joined our team a year ago and has brought her unique brand of creativity to everything she's touched. Tamika, from all of us at your Take Two family, we will miss you and love you. Thank you for such an awesome year you gave us. I'm Josie Huang. Take Two is back next week. We'll see you then.